Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, members of the Inukinut National HIV Alliance talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and the impacts of racism on access to healthcare.
Okay, I'd just like to acknowledge the country that I'm on here in Brisbane. I'm on Turrbal country. It's also significant that it's also Yagara country as well. I think the podcast is being recorded on Gadigal country in Sydney. I'm Colin Ross. I'm Jinnaburra from the Woodford area in southeast Queensland.
I'm the chair of the Inukinut National HIV Alliance, ANA.
And I'd just like to leave it open for everybody else to say where they're from.
So I'm Michael Doyle. I'm Bardi. I'm based here in Sydney. I'm on Gadigal country. I'm in Redfern at home. I work at Sydney Uni. I'm a board member of the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations and also a board member of ANA.
Hello, my name is Beverly Greach. I'm on the land of the Kulin Nations, living in Melbourne. I'm a Gudjimara woman, which is the area around Portland Hayward Way, and I represent on this committee, Inukinut Committee Women.
My name's Eddie Sinnott. I'm a Wamba Wamba man. I live and work on the Yuggera and Turrbal lands in Brisbane at Griffith University, and then also down at UNSW in Sydney as well. And I'm involved as the treasurer of Inukinut HIV Alliance and in a whole heap of other community programs, organisations as well.
I'm Michelle Tobin. I'm a Yorta Yorta woman who lives on Darkinyung country up on the central coast. And currently I'm on Gadigal country doing the podcast. I'm the HIV positive rep on the Inukinut National HIV Alliance. I'm also the Patson convener, Positive Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Network, and I'm also an Aboriginal Health Program Officer at Positive Life in New South Wales.
In 2020, Inukinut National HIV Alliance gave a media release about Black Lives Matter and will be available on the podcast. We might do is just go straight into the question and talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. It has recently gathered significant momentum around the world. I suppose one of the discussion points that we had earlier on was really about what was the significance around what Black Lives Mattered in the Australian space. What are some of the key elements or pathways Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people experience the negative impact of racism in Australia broadly, more specifically within the area of health? Does someone want to start with that? Michelle?
So the Black Lives Matters movement started because due to an incident that occurred in America that happened to a man called George Floyd, who passed away on the 25th of May due to an incident where he was accused of presenting forged dollar bills. And unfortunately, his death occurred at the hands of the Minnesota police. And there was an outcry in relation to what had happened to George Floyd in America and how this has happened many, many times beforehand. And so within Australia, we, as along with many others, decided to protest about what was happening to our mob back here. And at the time there was approximately 432 deaths that had occurred in custody. And since then, those numbers have gone up over to nearly 360, and which is very unfortunate.
In Australia, many of us participated in marches that occurred around the country back in around 2019. And that was in response to the 432 deaths that we had that had occurred within custody. And unfortunately, no one had been held accountable for any of those deaths. And, following on from that, we've had many police officers who have gone through the court system and only to be found not guilty, which has caused, major uproar within our Aboriginal communities right across our country, which, you know, has, you know, made us all stand up and look at what was happening within the prison systems and within custodies, and also what was happening on the streets with the way police were racially profiling our mob, and especially our younger generation, and the way they were being treated when being questioned, and, you know, so sort of made us stand up and, you know, need to think about how that needs to change. And obviously, you know, it goes back to systemic racism, which, you know, from, you know, we talk about the, like, police officers when they're being trained to become police officers and Aboriginal liaison officers, how important it is for them to understand, you know, the impacts of that type of racism that continues to happen for our community, and especially when it, you know, it goes into what's happening for our HIV positive brothers and sisters who have been targeted by police, and, you know, in the way that the police have questioned them in relation to carrying medications on them, and, you know, making them feel that they have to disclose certain aspects of their life, whether it be about HIV or other illnesses, in front of others where they're not, you know, comfortable speaking out about that. And but police are not aware of how detrimental that is to an individual, and how it also brings on stigma and discrimination. And, you know, when we look at the health systems as well, especially some of our AMSs, you know, we've got many of our Aboriginal people who are quite fair, like myself, and who are being, you know, feeling the impacts of negative racism due to the colour of their skin, and, you know, having to prove their identity. And, I mean, like, there's many Aboriginal, darker-skinned Aboriginal people who also being quite negative towards fairer people, you know, and especially ones from Stolen Generation, because of the fact they don't know where they come from. And so it's been quite hard for them to explain who their family is or who their mob are when, you know, we've got others out there labelling them as Johnny Come Latelys, which is, you know, quite detrimental to who they are as an individual. And, you know, for them to try and find where they come from and for where they belong, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done around educating, especially our own communities, about the impacts of racism, of, you know, what we do amongst ourselves and with others that's internal.
Thanks, Michelle. Michael, would you like to comment on that question?
Thanks, Colin. Look, I think the Black Lives Matter movement was a outlet for a lot of people, of a lot of pent-up frustration and anger towards the criminal justice system in the first instance. But as Michelle said, the systemic racism within Australian society, and it started in the United States. But I think the thing that we see that goes relatively unchallenged in Australia is white privilege. And so when the Black Lives Matter movement came forward, it wasn't to sort of say Black Lives Matter more than anybody else. But what it is about is that we need to care about Black people in the same way we care about everybody else, and not have what can sometimes be an indifference from mainstream to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Look, for sure, there are different ways and insidious ways of which discrimination can happen within and external to our community. Within our community, people who are fairer or who don't have a sense of exactly, you know, because they are Stolen Generation, as Michelle said, can be more discriminated against. But they can also inadvertently be exposed to discrimination other people don't, aren't exposed to. So comments to somebody who's assumed to be white being said about those, you know, dirty Aboriginals or something. And so you end up hearing things that are just absolutely obscene, is what I've been told from family members who are fairer as well. So there's different ways in which people can be affected by that discrimination. I think in terms of what we do within our space with ANA and the HIV world and STIs, We need to really have a better tolerance, I think, overall for what can be a bit of an indifference, if you like, towards LGBTI issues, and to not bully in any way or discriminate in any way against anybody who might be a bit different from who other people are. So teasing somebody because of the way they speak, the way they dress, the way in which they choose to express their sexuality and their identity. And those are all sort of concepts around the Black Lives Matter movement that's about sort of how we need to treat people fairly and within our LGBTI and our HIV community, these messages are really powerful as well. That's it for me. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks, Michael. Bev?
In the health area. Well, having worked in the health area, mainly in community controlled health organisations and some mainstream in sexual health, it's a sort of double discrimination that happens in this country of not only being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, but also being HIV positive. And so there's, from mainstream, there's a lot of discrimination, but also some mainstream organisations try and run programs for our communities which don't fit, and, one doesn't fit all. And I think we have to work largely in self-determination and community control areas, so within the health system as well as the legal system, and that mainstream organisations, they need to not just think by having someone, an Aboriginal person on their board or one Aboriginal worker. It, to me, reeks of tokenism, which is largely what it is, and this is a racist country. In the prisons, having spent about 20 years going into prisons and talking to the women, mainly the women, that are in there for very minor things. And I'm very concerned about this. The age limit is 10 years old to go in detention. So that really needs to be gotten rid of and built much older than that. But also things like public drunkenness needs to be sort of, because they're all means of targeting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And recently we even had yet another death in custody, that Aboriginal woman was, virtually dying in her cell, and no one went and checked on her. In fact, one of the workers was watching a movie while she was screaming out. So I think we need to redress the whole justice system, but also within the health area, that things should come from community control, design, and in partnership, and if need be, in partnership with mainstream, and therefore our voices will be heard, because it'll be a good match to our own needs and wishes, rather than having needs and wishes imposed on us. We've had funding for various sexual health prevention, like Condom Man and NAIC and all sorts of things, but a lot of those fundings have been a one-off. They last, maybe 1 or 2 years and that's it. And even though they're very successful, they don't get to continue. So we, it's very important that these programs, which are initiated within the community, are properly funded and ongoing funding.
Yeah, thanks, Bev. Eddie, would you like to comment on that question?
Yeah, I guess it's good, having had the benefit of listening to the others as well. And something I'm reminded of, or that I was thinking of as they were speaking, and I guess my area of expertise particularly is the law and public policy through governance measures, and how it impacts our people and our communities too. And that, that crosses across, whether it be the health sector or the criminal justice sector. They're not There's important areas of, you know, individual expertise in them, but they so often cross over when it comes to the health and well-being of our community. And I think what all of the examples that have been discussed so far have shown, and what Black Lives Matter really highlighted here locally, was the continuance of this just reckless disregard and, you know, abandonment of our people. Or so it comes through in that disbelief or some of the responses to when the kind of spotlight got shifted back to our own backyard by some of, you know, the political class, but even some of our allies as well, that things just aren't that bad here. You know, things are different to what they are in America. We don't have the same level of gun violence that they do, or our police isn't militarized to the same extent. But it doesn't mean that the violences, and especially the institutional and systemic way that these violences continue to impact our people, isn't experienced in any, you know, lesser way, or doesn't have less of an impact on our people. And so, you know, we've often had to deal with that expectation or attitude of people that, you know, the chip on the shoulder that Black fellows are said to have to get over it, to move on. And, you know, as some of the others have already spoken about, we've internalized that a lot too. There's a lot of trauma in our community that we take out on each other, and that we force that reckless kind of abandonment and disregard that's fueled by ignorance without wanting, you know, refusing to learn and to understand how things are actually impacting people, and just blaming individuals or, you know, blaming our community for their issues and not taking a holistic approach. And it's, you know, as Bev was saying, the community controlled aspect here is such an important part of this history as well, because the community controlled sector was started because the government treated us so poorly. We turned inwards to our own people and said, no one else is doing, you know, we realized no one else was doing this for us, and we turned to the strength of our communities to help ourselves. And in many ways, a lot of those community controlled organizations, not of their own fault, but through the reality of the resources that they need, and the just the sheer task of the challenge and the responsibility before them, have kind of been co-opted or have left, you know, hand out to the government and restrained in that way. And so for decades, you know, we've been going through this cycle, and then something like Black Lives Matter comes along. There's the, you know, kind of indignant outrage, righteous outrage kind of thing for very good reasons of what happened to George Floyd and what happened to others over there at the Ferguson riots, and the violence that is still meted out upon Black Americans. But as soon as we saw that turned inward, and for the very legitimate, you know, reasons that it is here. So, you know, as Bev mentioned there again, things that should have been introduced and things that were part of recommendations for the Royal Commission on Deaths in Custody. So there was the one there in Victoria a couple of years ago where an Indigenous woman, a Yorta Yorta woman, was picked up for being drunk in public and was dead in her cell within 24 hours. Mm. And public drunkenness was one of the, you know, recommendations by the Royal Commission to remove. And it's complete negligence. And you can read this time and time again in every coroner's report there is into a death in custody. The same recommendations are made. The same, you know, people aren't held to account. They talk about police training. They talk about structures. And nothing seemingly ever changes because people keep dying. And at the end of the day, I think what we saw here erupt is the natural kind of result of a system that continues to oppress people and fails to offer meaningful solutions. And so what other way is there for people to gain the attention and to demand the rightful respect that we should have to be able to address these issues than to, you know, erupt into protests into the streets? It's something that a lot of commentators in the US have failed to comprehend, because of, you know, the centuries of failing to deal with that issue there and the systematic way that they've oppressed Black people there. And it's something that our country still fails with as well. We like to pretend that we had the 67 referendum, that we removed all of the oppressive pieces of legislation, and that we include Indigenous peoples now. But no matter what kind of sector you look at, all of the data's there, you know, excuse me, the facts speak for themselves. Yeah. As Michael said, that, you know, racism still plays such a, and you know, the others said as well, racism is still one of, you know, the major determining factors when it comes into our health and well-being. And that's what we saw erupt when that scope was forced back onto Australia. Non-Indigenous Australians especially were forced to ask that question of themselves, but also, as Michael said, And Michelle, we were forced to ask that of ourselves when it comes to our own community and treatment of others.
Thank you, Eddie, for that. You know, I think that we've made the point that racism in all of its forms impacts on all of our lives, whether it's institutional racism, individual racism or internal racism. It impacts us across the whole country. Certainly what Black Lives Matter's done is that it's shone a light on it here in Australia and certainly has in the US. I think that the momentum in Australia is a little bit different. Like you said, we haven't got that gun culture, but we have the culture of colonialism. And the way that colonialism in this country has impacted on all of our lives is certainly something that stands out. One of the things that Michelle talked about was around, you know, issues of access for HIV positive people, for women, for our Black queer community, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, gender, brother, boy, sister, girl community, the way that stigma and discrimination impacts on our lives as far as access to health. In some cases, we do get access, and in other cases, we don't. It's determined by the particular services that we go to. Some are friendly around issues of gender, gay identity, and individuality. But really, it's about this whole notion of Black Lives Matter for us is certainly around that whole thing of access and acceptance across the whole country in all of our communities. Whether they be remote, isolated, urban, rural, you know, these are the things that we want to, that impact on us negatively. And, we're asking for change around a whole range of those issues. Would anyone else like to make any further comments on some of the things that they talked about? Particularly in relation to, you know, where we see our main target population, which is HIV positive people, the LGBTIQ, because I mean that's really what the focus of these podcasts will be about. It'll be about that. It'll be about those individual groups talking about a whole range of things that happen with them, particularly around Black Lives Matter and how what their lived experience is in our community. I think that stuff's really important. To look at the mental health of all of our target populations, to look at suicide prevention within the Black queer community, within the HIV positive community. So yeah, has anybody else got anything to add to that?
I just wanted to touch on the fact of what media plays in the role of, you know, creating racism as well as stigma and discrimination for not just the HIV positive community, but especially a transgender community. You know, when we look back at the case that happened in WA a couple of years ago, where a transgender woman was placed into a male's prison and her treatment was refused, and you know, and just the way she was paraded on national TV, you know, and labelled as a transgender with HIV and, you know, who had deliberately gone out and infected her clients, you know, I think that needs to be addressed as well, that, you know, the media has a lot to answer for when it comes to, you know, stirring the pot when it comes to racism and feeding communities on jumping on the bandwagon.
So what do you think are some of the things that we could do about that?
It's probably the same as what we would say to most people, where we think that there's cultural training that needs to be brought in, and, you know, and maybe we need to encourage them to be engaging with with the ANA or with Patson, or anyone within that, you know, transgender groups, to be able to come in and give lived experience talks to, you know, give them a bit of an understanding of, you know, the impacts of what their work can do to somebody, you know, when they're putting it out there that's not right.
I think the trans issue was, it was the use and manipulation of a particular group of people in order to try to say, well, we're normal, they're not. I'm talking about the political debate that happened, and it was just absolutely appalling, I think, the way in which trans issues for trans people were just... It's. I hope that we've moved from where that was to a different place, and that no specific community is used as sort of a political football, if you like. So I guess I'm being quite frank with that in this podcast, but that's what I really do believe happened. I think for our sister girls and brother boys, we still have a way to go within our own Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, within our Aboriginal LGBTI community, to have full acceptance and just to accept people for who they are and not judging or acting in any strange way towards somebody because that's who they are. And so we still have a bit of work to do around that.
Eddie, sorry, Michael.
Yeah, I was just going to say representation matters. And sometimes it's as simple as saying that to get it across to people. But of course, in practice, it's not that simple because there's a whole lot of problems with that. You just can't burden individuals with the expectation that they can represent for their entire community or everyone else's lived experience either. But there is something that I think rings true to the expression that representation matters, and that you can't be representative, you know, your experience or your people isn't there at the table as part of, you know, decision-making. It's part of taking into account how some of these measures that we talk about in the health sector, especially, going to roll out into communities and going to be able to help you. And, you know, for the longest time, it's, you know, similar to the Me Too movement as well, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Your point exactly, Eddie, about this representation stuff, I think when you look at LGBTIQ plus brother boys and sister girls, I mean, it's really about hearing the voice of Black lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, transgender, intersex, brother boys, sister girls. So it's really about, this is really the aim of the podcast, is to try and gather those voices and hear what their lived experience is about, you know, a whole range of issues around access to services, about their lives, about the stigma and discrimination, you know, looking at the mental health issues and the, you know, the suicide prevention and living with HIV and all of those, you know, all of those particular issues. I'd like to just move into the next question, which is, what are some of the ways to start reform in these areas to improve the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? Really thinking about, you know, who our target population is, looking outside the box, looking at, you know, what are those services and organisations and even individuals that can help start to reform some of these things around Black Lives Matter for, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, whether it's incarceration, you know, there's a whole range of things there. So I'll just open that up for anyone to start off.
Recently, I've done some speaking with the Speaking Bureau to the new recruits of the police, as well as new recruits of PSOs, which are the ones that stand at railway stations or get on trams or whatever. But I think it's really important. One way to reform is for us to have a voice in order to speak to in any training course for people working in the area of justice of the issues that we face on a day-to-day basis and how to reduce the sense of judgmental, you know, judgmentalism as well as discrimination, and to have a better understanding. I mean, I think that we need to put the word out. We need to put the word out to all areas of, you know, legal or health, that we have a voice and that we need to use that voice in order to talk about our issues. Now, it's not just about talking about the issues and then they think, oh, well, I can tick that box. It's maybe running like a reconciliation action plan for the communities to have a better sense of sensitivity to the issues for positive people. Also, there needs to be definite reform of incarcerating people from the ages of 10 children, as well as the whole getting rid of this public drunkenness, because I think those sort of issues are used as an excuse to target Aboriginal people, and I think we're unfairly targeted for that. So there's some of my suggestions of reform. I might think of others later.
So I think off the back of what Bev was saying, law reform sometimes gets a bad rep. I'm an avid fan of it, however, it's my expertise and that's what I research in. But for law reform to work, it has to be serious in the sense that, you know, actual structural things that impact. So when we're talking about the age of incarceration for our youth, as Bev mentioned there, it's still at 10. And the last Closing the Gap targets didn't try and, you know, weren't aiming to get parity in the incarceration rates until 2050. And so considering the, you know, the age there of, you know, you can be locked up at 10 and the thing of not reaching parity with the non-Indigenous population until 2050, it's basically condemning another three generations of, you know, of many of our youth to incarceration, which is just beyond belief. But for law reform to be serious and impactful in those senses, it needs to, you know, actually change the law. People need to be held accountable, which is probably one of the biggest things that doesn't happen yet. When you don't have a culture of accountability through governance, then things continue to happen as though they did before. And it doesn't matter how many laws you change, how many policies you put in place. People are never held to account, or those laws are never fully enforced to the, you know, full extent of what they should be. Then, you know, it just doesn't matter. The culture and the attitudes that go along with it have to change along with that too. And then I think, you know, the biggest aspect that goes along with a lot of that all of the time is resources. You know, people, again, like to point at our community and say we've always got a handout, which is just bullshit. But our communities and our organisations are screaming out for, you know, the actual resources they need to be able to implement these programs, to be able to do the education and training. And it's just not good enough that, you know, this day and age in the wealthy country that we live in as well, but we can't find those resources to be able to stop our youth from ending up in prison, to be able to stop all of the discrimination that occurs. And, you know, at the end of the day, to be able to stop people from being locked up in prison cells where they die as well. And because we know statistically, you know, more so for Indigenous people, it's a matter of fact that chances are more likely for you that you'll end up dead if you end up in prison than it is for someone else.
So one of the things that the ANA Black Lives Matter statement is making is that, you know, we're over the reports, we're over the research, you know, all of this stuff is being done. What about how can people start to implement some of that stuff? What are the reforms around, you know, somewhere along the line they've got to stop locking 10-year-olds up, or 12-year-olds, or 13-year-olds. I mean, there's something out there that's not working for us. So if there's all of these recommendations that haven't been implemented, what is that about? Is that about resources? Is it about money? Is it about, you know, because it impacts on the lives of our target population.
Well, that one in particular is about the power of decision-making. So, you know, a lot of people will point the finger at community and say there's a lot more that could be done. So, you know, 10-year-olds don't end up in a situation where they could go to prison. But, you know, that's not the point, really. And again, that's just victim blaming or putting it back on the community. When, as I said, you know, we're stripped of resources and the capacity to actually be able to deal with a lot of those issues. The simplest thing that government and politicians in this country can do, and which most have refused to do to this date, except for, I believe, the ACT Attorney General, is to raise the age. So there's a national campaign to do that in Australia. raising the age to what it is at the international standard. All of that is backed by all of the expert evidence and research around, you know, criminality and childhood development, and then how low socioeconomic impact on community development and brain development and everything else too. But that's where I think that thing that I spoke about before, and Bev spoke to as well, about being able to have a voice that's heard in a substantive structural way that actually has an impact. So when it comes down to the decisions that are actually made, us having a seat at the table that is actually substantive and has an influence and an impact and can change those decisions is something that can happen now, should happen now. And it doesn't have to wait for state and territory or national or local governments. It's something organisations, especially mainstream organisations, can implement themselves, rather than hoarding all of the power and continuing to pretend, you know, even our allies, that they know best. They can actually start changing the way they make decisions immediately, and that will have an immediate impact.
So is there any comment from anyone else about how those allies or how those agencies might change their ways, in the sense of certainly if you look at the ANA in its coming on 30 years, clearly what we as an organisation have done is completely, you know, we've constantly scrimped and saved to exist. Now, any other organisation would probably fold, but I mean, you know, we're still here doing these, beginning to do these podcasts, in the sense of we want this discussion. We want this discussion. We want this voice to be heard, but we want it to be heard politically, community, and individually. So yeah. And there needs to be something like this. You know, these podcasts could create that little hook that we need to discuss all of these issues in a meaningful way. Anybody else with this question?
As Eddie had said, you know, and I had said also earlier, that having a place at the table is one of the most important things, because, you know, when we talk about HIV and there's a 95-95 target that all the non-Indigenous HIV organisations are striving to get to, and we're the ones that are still being left behind. And for that to change, they need to make sure that there are places at that table where we can bring what we know and what we have seen and what we've lived through to be able to make a change, and for to be included within those targets. I mean, obviously it comes back to a lot of fun. You know, we don't have a lot of funding to recreate resources, but the non-Indigenous community sector has a lot of funding that they've been able to create resources and posters, you know, to inform the non-Indigenous community. So why not engage with us and use their funding to create posters and resources that are culturally appropriate, that we know that, you know, our community needs. And so I think, you know, for the positive, when it comes to being HIV and getting the information out there to our communities, you know, we need to be assisted to be able to do that. But we need to make sure that we're able to sit at that table, but not as a tokenistic, so they can tick their boxes that this is what they've done, but the fact that they are working with us to better the lives of our community.
Clearly box tickers don't make Black lives matter, do they?
No.
You know,
their lives matter.
You know, it's about them. So, you know, I think that in saying all of this, I think that, you know, as we go through these podcasts, I think that we probably need to do a little sum up here, and in the sense of, I don't know, a comment from each of you about, you know, what we'd like to see moving forward, particularly when we're going to look at other people doing podcasts like HIV positive people, women, gay men, sister girls, brother boys. I don't know, I'd just like to get some comments, or if there are, you know, any other points around, you know, some of the ways that we can start this reform process. Is it what discussions do we need to have with our new Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander politicians that are now sitting in the new government?
Well, we need to request to have a voice, to speak to them, that we have a meeting and speak to the people that are running the, well, who have their new positions with the new government, and they need to be informed as to what our concerns and issues are. So if it's possible that we meet with them, that would be wonderful.
So how do we as a community, how do we as an ANA community talk to our community? How do we talk to our community? What do we need to do that?
Well, when it comes to HIV or STIs, we need to get permission from communities to be able to go in there and have those discussions. But more so, how do we, you know, have those discussions with our elders and the youth? Maybe talking to the sexual health nurses to get a better understanding of what's actually happening in the communities, what the community is aware when it comes to sexual health, especially around testing, the uptake of treatments, you know, what information's out there, and to look at, you know, how we fill that gap.
Eddie?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think this podcast series is an important opportunity for us to do all of that, to speak directly to the community, the organisation is engaged with and wants to re-engage with and represent, you know, if those people are comfortable doing that through this series, but also, you know, through that history that you detailed, Colin, and most recently in the last couple of years where we've mapped out where we kind of sit and where we want to be and how hard that is, you know, and that has been because we've had to go cap in hand to try and get the resources to exist, right? So I think this is another important part of that exercise, or that, you know, we can use it in that way to enable people to feed into that, into this, and for us to, you know, leverage that in the best way that we can to be able to ensure that those voices through this mechanism can be heard and can have an impact, as Bev was saying.
Well, I think as this podcast series progresses, there's kind of two audiences, and one is the LGBTI and HIV positive Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. The other one is more for the general public and health services, and there are similar messages but slightly different messages to both groups. I think within our own community, hold on, things are, we know you might be in a difficult spot, but things do get better, and there are people around, there are organisations around, and please talk to somebody. Well, the other services, we for a long time in the LGBTI space have known that we don't just fit people into a box, that we're just going to offer a generic service and everybody's yep. going to get the same thing. So we need to keep that spirit of that fantastic work we've done over so many years, and to continue to re-energise that so that we make sure everybody gets their own sort of unique service that's tailored to their own needs.
Yes, that's right, Michael. And I think the other thing is that we've actually got the evidence, we've got the proof that, you know, that we've done a lot of work in the space. And, you know, I think that's very important to acknowledge that, and that we will continue to do that, you know, in a positive way.
It's been a while since Black Lives Matter happened, and a lot has happened in our communities. You know, we had the COVID pandemic, which for many different reasons stressed and further, you know, stretched a lot of those resource and community organisations and our people in similar ways for what we're talking about as well. So I think we've been able to get a little bit off the chest today in our short conversation as well about what has been happening and what issues still persist. And a good reminder of, although Black Lives Matter was a bit of a flash in the pan when it happened, that those issues just don't go away overnight, and the serious business of achieving substantial reform still exists for us. So I think it's been a good conversation to start and to narrow down onto some of the specifics and different areas that we want to talk about over the podcast series.
Thanks, Eddie.
Yes, and I also want to say that I was springing back to the old ACT UP, which was for activism for people with HIV, that the saying of silence equals death. So unless we have a voice, a seat at the table and a voice and a proper instigator of services and care and support, we just die. And that shows up very clearly in deaths in custody, the actual life
expectancy.
Expectancy. It does mean death, son. So I think it's really important to have that voice. But to have that voice, say, like even in something like a roadshow or whatever, to have that voice We need funding. You know, we need more support. It seems like in the last 5 years that I'm aware of, a lot of services that we did have gone, disappeared. We need to have a voice.
Yeah. Thanks, Beth. Michael?
As the epidemic changes, some of our way in which we work within this area is going to need to be augmented in some way. So HIV, the epidemic is on the decline in Australia, is one way of putting it. There's less and less cases among gay, white, middle-class men is what's happening. Mm. And so of the new cases that are happening right now, a greater proportion of those cases, Aboriginal people make up a greater proportion of that. So there aren't more cases per se. There's a lot less cases of HIV. But as services change, we need to think about how can we further target those services to better meet the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be HIV positive. And how do we then think about making sure that we continue to work in the LGBTI space, which is incredibly important? Because we've ended up in a situation where we've kind of worked both at the same time, because most of the HIV has been with among, you know, gay men and within that particular community. But those two things are starting to perhaps, they'll always be very closely aligned, but they're starting to be a little bit different in the terms of how services might be delivered.
Thanks, Michael.
I think
Michelle.
For our community, that when people are looking at going to have their STI checks, they need to think about having a HIV test. And if that test comes back positive, then to get onto treatment as soon as possible, you know, to prevent any further transmissions, which if you are on treatment, there's, you know, less likely chances of you being able to pass that virus on to anybody else. So you're not only protecting yourself, but you're also protecting others around you. And that's really important. We need to make sure that our non-Indigenous HIV sectors are working alongside our Aboriginal services and the community to making sure that resources are adapted to the community and are culturally appropriate, especially around PrEP and the importance of treatment and testing and those sort of things. And when it comes to racism in this country, you know, the only way we can stamp it out is if we all walk that same path together.
Thank you very much, Michelle. So thank you, everybody.